everyone. This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here today with Matt Forney. Hey, Matt, it's nice having you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
So we're going to be discussing your review of Mark Ames's book, Going Postal. Before we get started with that, could you just sort of give a brief introduction to yourself? As you guys know, you're the blogger formerly known as Ferdinand Bartomeu.
Yeah, I stopped writing my original blog in Malafide a year ago and decided to go public under my real name because I really didn't have anything to lose. I wanted to go in a different direction as to what I was normally doing, concentrating more on self-improvement and self-betterment. So I came public with the knowledge of a little while back because I was initially worried about repercussions, but as it turns out, nobody really cares. In fact, they respect me more for writing under my real name now, so...
So you were saying Mark Ames was one of your biggest early influences on your work.
Yes, I was a big fan of his old satirical magazine, The Exile, when I was a teenager. Again, it's he says a lot of things I disagree with. I mean, we would probably hate each other if we met each other in person. But he's such an accurate writer, and he's right on so many things, from like Spreesters to his coverage of Russia, that I can't simply dismiss him. And Going Postal is probably one of his best works in this vein.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying you're willing to sort of put up with some of his stuff. Like, he is sort of a typical leftist when it comes to like whining about racism, for instance.
Oh yeah. I mean, I came across a tweet from the other day in which he referred to John Derbyshire, you know, for his Tacky Mag article as a white supremacist creep. But the thesis of stuff like Going Postal is so original, so breathtaking that, you know, you can't. It would be intellectually dishonest for me to, you know, dismiss him on that alone.
So what society generally says about spree shootings is that the people are simply sort of, they're simply deranged wackos, evil individuals, or generally liberals will try to say we need more gun control, and then conservatives will say they'll blame it on violent video games, for instance.
Yeah, but yeah, it's basically Ames's thesis in Going Postal is that that's totally wrong. He postulates that spree shootings are effectively a modern form of slave rebellions. Basically, they are mentally ill people. He doesn't dispute the fact that the spree shooters are mentally ill and frankly are monsters, but they're reacting to a monstrous situation. Constant humiliation, pay cuts, having their benefits cut, or in the case of schools, institutionalized bullying and the stress of standardized tests basically causes people who are already immensely fragile to snap. And the objective of these spree shootings is basically to destroy the company or to destroy the school. The shooter comes in with the intention of basically wiping everything out, from the people at the bottom to the people, to the managers and the bosses most of all.
So the beginning of this, the very first spree shooting was a postal worker in 1986, and Ames, he points out that the whole economy was restructured under Ronald Reagan, and which is known as Reaganomics.
Yes, basically. Prior to Reagan's presidency, most Americans effectively had universal health care through their employers. It was very rare to not have it. Wages were much higher. Unemployment was lower. And Reagan came in and destroyed all that under the aegis of supply-side economics. And the thing is that not only did this make life for the average American, and he also destroyed unions, literally in the case of the Air Traffic Controllers Union. But and the thing is that despite, you know, conservatives and libertarians claiming that Reagan's policies created economic growth, Ames crunched the numbers and found out that growth in Reagan's presidency only increased by 0.4% over Jimmy Carter's presidency, an increase of less than one half of 1%, which doesn't really justify the wide sweeping changes he and his allies introduced to the American economy.
And he also talks about slavery, pointing out that there were actually a lot more slave revolts in the Caribbean as opposed to in the United States. Because the slaves were sort of, they were able to psychologically condition them to accept their slavery.
Yes, basically, When it came to slaves that were brought over to the New World by the French or the Spanish, they did not do an effective job as breaking down morale, which is why you had, for example, the Haitian Revolution, which was basically just a gigantic slave revolt. Whereas slaves that came to the Americas, I mean, to the 13 colonies and later to the U.S., were psychologically broken down in that the slave owners would mix up slaves from different tribes so that there would be no internal cohesion. They forbade slaves from speaking in native African tongues, and they also forcibly converted their slaves to Christianity and destroyed, native tribal religions. The various voodoo religions from like Haiti and certain other parts of the Caribbean originate from the fact that the French did not forcibly convert their slaves to Christianity. And these techniques were further developed by slave owners in the South and elsewhere into basically giving slaves a limited amount of freedom. Ames discovered that slaves were not were allowed to they were allowed to own property. They were allowed to walk into town when they were done with their work. They were permitted to visit other slaves. They could even earn a limited amount of money, which they could use to buy stuff, sell excess crops from the plantation, and even to, woo a mate to, marry. And the reason, and they, th and this all combined to, sort of normalize slavery in people's in the slaves' minds, made them less inclined to revolt. This is why we had over few centuries that we had slavery in America. There are maybe less than a dozen slave revolts in this country or in 13 colonies because of this.
And so, yeah, I mean, he compares those are the same tactics that corporations use today.
Yeah, basically, I mean, and the other thing is he also mentioned is that white indentured servants that were brought over here from Europe were actually treated worse than black slaves because black slaves had a The plantation owners had an incentive to keep black slaves healthy and productive because they could either resell them directly at slave auctions or have them have kids who would in turn, create more profit. There was no incentive in this regard with indentured servants, so the plantation owners had every intention to just work them to the bone. And the same techniques are being used by corporations today and CEOs and managers today to condition their workers. They allow By making it so workers feel that their interests are the same as the employer's interests. What is good for the CEO is what is good for the rest of the employees, that sort of thing. And this illusion of freedom is what keeps people from recognizing that, holy crap, I live a terrible life. I'm working 80-hour work weeks, my pay sucks. I have no free time. My boss humiliates me on a daily basis, and they're given just enough freedom so that they can, rationalize their situation, but not enough that they can actually, enjoy their lives.
And his thing is, he points out is in the Reagan era, I mean, sociopaths like Donald Trump and Jack Welch were actually regarded as folk heroes for humiliating their employees.
Well, not well, not well, not well, not. Not in the 80s so much in regards to Donald Trump. That was, but more. That's a more recent thing. Like The Apprentice is still on, and the entire appeal of The Apprentice, his show, is that we watch him humiliating the people he employs, berating them, and then firing them. I mean, I don't watch the show. My mother does, and I was visiting her a couple years ago. And relative to when it was first on the air about a decade ago, the boardroom segments where Donald Trump debriefs his employees and interrogates them are now they comprise about half of the show. I mean, that's the part that people actually want to watch, the part where he humiliates people. And we identify with people like Jack Welch, who acquired the nickname Neutron Jack because in the 80s he would fire whole swaths of people from General Electric, and he bragged that when he was done, the only thing standing, was the buildings, the neutron track as in neutron bombs. And we honored these people who biggest claims to fame for their companies is firing people, humiliating people, slashing their pay, slashing their benefits. We don't honor, say, Costco, which gives all of their employees a living wage. They pay much more than the market average, or something like, or a company like, say, Chick-fil-A, which adheres to their Christian principles so much that they're not open on Sundays and other things. We don't honor corporations that put principles above profit. We honor those who put profit above everything else. And that sort of, speaks to how ingrained the slave mentality is in us, that we even watch this sort of thing as our entertainment.
So, how many spree shootings happened during the Reagan era? I know the first one was in '86, was a postal worker, hence the phrase going postal.
The first postal shooting actually began in Illinois towards the 70s because it was under Richard Nixon that the Postal Service was first made to become pro was a law was passed that made the Postal Service become proper, which is a requirement that was never imposed on any other government agency. And because of this requirement that the Postal Service has to turn a profit, that basically they started cutting costs, cutting employees' benefits, and basically the sorts of people who got promoted into positions of power in the Postal Service were those who were basically near sociopathic and were just, concerned with the bottom line. It was Reagan's innovation was taking this and applying it to all private sector workers, not just postal workers. Prior to Reagan, spree shootings were virtually non-existent. I mean, and they happened for entirely different reasons. For the most famous postal shooting that happened before Reagan's era was Brenda Spencer in 1979 in San Diego. She opened fire on the elementary school across from her home. She was a teenager and killed a number of students. And when she was arrested, she said to police that the reason she killed those elementary school kids is because she was bored. I mean, she said, "I don't like Mondays," an exact quote, which inspired the pop song, "I Don't Like Mondays." And she didn't open fire on her own school. She opened fire on an elementary school. She was a teenager. But starting with the 80s, we had guys like Joseph Westbecker, who was the first major private sector spree shooter in the late 80s. And then we had shooters like the Columbine shooters in the 90s. And basically, that's the number of spree shooters absolutely exploded after when Reagan became president. It just keeps going up. And that speaks to a specific pattern that American society fundamentally changed then. To make, our more mentally ill segments of the population want to lash out in violence, anything to escape the hell of their daily lives.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of right-wingers, and this includes the alternative right as well, they're always complaining about egalitarianism. But, I mean, our society, it's extremely politically correct when it comes to, I mean, you can't criticize women, you can't criticize any ethnic minorities. But on the other hand, it's become extremely unegalitarian and more so as we through time.
Yeah, basically, we at the same time that we are basically becoming poor, income mobility has fallen off a cliff since the 80s. The gap between the rich and the poor is wider now than it's ever been at any point in American history. Yet at the same time, we are increasingly muzzled in terms of what we can and can't say. If you say something politically incorrect, if you say something that's perceived to be misogynistic, if you say something that's perceived to be racist or homophobic, you can see your entire career go up in smoke. And so at the same time that we're becoming poorer, we're becoming less free in terms of what we and the ideas that we can express and how we can express ourselves. And you can't say something that's truthful without an entire angry horde of people screaming for you to lose your job, or that in some countries even, being prosecuted for hate speech.
I think one of the reasons, I think there's two reasons why a lot of the spree shooters are white. One of them is that whites are more likely to be socially isolated because other groups have a stronger sense of community. And I think the other reason is economic. I mean, blacks and Mexicans have traditionally been lower class, but I think whites are kind of used to a high standard of living. I mean, if you look at James Holmes, for instance, he came from a very prosperous upper middle class suburban background, and now he finds out that there's no jobs available. So a lot of it has to do is that, while whites on average have a higher income than blacks or Hispanics, they're suffering a big decline from the destruction of the middle class.
Yeah, basically, the white what when you start out from a position of wealth and you start losing that wealth and there's nothing you can do about it, you're going to be angrier than if you start out poorer because you're used to this sort of thing. And I used to work when I was a teenager. I worked at a Kmart part time to make money, and it was an absolutely humiliating and obnoxious job. I can't go into the I don't want to go into the details on this interview, but I once joked that the only reason we haven't seen a postal shooting from a Kmart or a Walmart or a Target employee is because they don't pay them enough to afford guns, basically. I mean, kind of macabre, but you get the idea. We usually see these spree shootings among people who are from the middle class but are seeing their income decline because they're the ones who are being hardest hit relative to their position in American society.
I know there's some idiot on your site accusing you of being a leftist, but what they don't get, what we have is sort of, it's a combination of the extreme worst aspects of both capitalism and socialism.
Yeah, I mean, there's another book in this vein that I highly recommend. I haven't reviewed it yet on my blog, but I will soon. It's called The Managerial Revolution by James Burnham, in which he postulates that basically capitalism as we imagine it died basically following World War I, but it wasn't replaced by socialism. We don't have socialism. I mean, a large government bureaucracy, you know, meeting out gimme dats and sucking up more and more taxpayer money is not socialism by the Marxist definition. What we have is managerialism, as he terms it, which is ruled by the managers. Administrators, CEOs, engineers, human resources people, they're not capitalists in the traditional sense, but they're not of the working class either. And it's under this managerial system that basically that this bizarre hybrid of the worst aspects of capitalism and socialism has come about. And basically, when conservatives attack, say, Occupy Wall Street or whatever for being socialist or whatever and defending CEOs, they're not defending, like, people. They imagine that they're defending people like Andrew Carnegie that made their wealth on their own, but richest people in society now are not, you know, Horatio Alger, pull yourself up from your bootstraps types. They're types like John Corzine, Lloyd Blankfein, Hank Paulson, the Koch brothers, George Soros, who made their money basically by stealing it or outright, you know, ripping people off. And that's not capitalism. It's a completely entirely different form of government.
And the other thing was if the education system, Reagan was the one who started pushing all these standardized testing, and that changed the whole environment of school.
Yes, it used to be school was more about holistic learning, but nowadays it's basically about if you don't get good scores on your SAT, if you don't get good grades in high school and college, you're basically screwed. The rush of people going to college is part of this. I mean, prior to the 70s, merely having a bachelor's degree or any kind of college degree was enough to get a job because not many people went to college. But now with everyone going to college, the value of a college degree has collapsed, so now they analyze your grades, they analyze your extracurricular activities, and when you're looking to get into college, they analyze your – you have to take AP courses, you have to get perfect grades, you have to – ace your SATs and ACTs, and if you fall behind just once, your entire career can be screwed up, which is why you end up with student cheating scandals like what happened in Atlanta. Ames analyzes one that happened in Saratoga, California, which is the wealthy suburb in of San Francisco where he grew up. Basically, you know, colleges and schools are no longer focused on learning. They're focused on getting that number, and if they have to cheat or modify, you know, break the rules to get that number, you know, students and teachers will do it, which is not helping our students at all. This high-pressure environment is just causing people to snap.
And, I mean, do you think bullying has gotten worse, or has it always been bullying obviously has been around as long as humanity has existed, but would you say it's gotten worse than it was in the past?
I'd say it's gotten worse, in part because, number one, bullying to a certain extent is institutionalized in certain schools. For example, in his analysis of the Columbine shootings, Ames found out that popular athletes were basically allowed to terrorize whoever they wanted, and the principal and administration would do nothing about it. There was a popular, I think he was a wrestling star, who was known for bashing kids' faces into lockers. He would make anti-Semitic taunts at Jewish students, you know, another Jew in the oven, another Jew in the oven. But whenever the parents of these students complained to administration, they did nothing because the guy was a popular athlete. And the other aspect of the reason why bullying is so more prevalent in schools nowadays is because the pacifistic reforms introduced by baby boomer teachers and administrators basically forbid people from fighting. I mean, back in the when, say, our parents' generation was growing up, if a kid was being bullied and he clocked the bully, you know, the administration would just let him off, you know. He was, you know, defending himself. But when I was a kid, I got into scrapes with bullies in elementary school, and whenever I did, they would haul us both in and punish us both because of their principle that violence is always wrong, even in self-defense. Even if you're defending yourself from someone who is harassing you day in and day out, you're not allowed to defend yourself.
Which, yeah, I mean, ironically, violence is actually an equalizer as opposed to just a rigid social structure without violence.
Yeah, basically, if we allowed bullied kids to just beat the beat the shit out of the people who are tormenting them, we'd have far less school shootings because they'd be able to let their frustration out and, you know, teach the kids a lesson, you know. Now we have it just builds up like a pressure cooker, this frustration, until they finally lash out, grab an AR-15, walk into school on a Monday morning and just waste everyone they see.
It's the same way with the police state in general. I think the other issue with, if you compare middle-class white people with lower-class blacks and Hispanics are more likely to get their anger out in a fist fight because white people are more obedient of the police state. They're more likely to hold in their rage.
Oh yeah. I mean, we see what happens with situations like, you know, Trayvon Martin and whatnot, or the sheer amount of violence in the black ghettos or whatnot. You know, it's like they're more likely to just, you know, if they're frustrated, they're more likely to just, you know, do something about it, whereas whites will bottle it in until it finally overflows.
And I know whenever a spree shooting happens, all the bloggers in the manosphere, they bring up the issue of a sexual frustration. Does Ames touch on that in his book?
He does touch on it, and he does admit that it is a factor, but it's not a primary one. I used to sort of argue this myself, but I've sort of dropped it because it's a secondary factor at best. Some of these guys are sexually frustrated, but the number one factor is that they're just so humiliated by bullies and by teachers and by administrators. That's the act that causes them to snap. Sexual frustration on its own just, you know, makes people, it's not a good thing, but it doesn't drive people to murderous rage unless it's combined with more serious factors such as the constant humiliation going day in, day out.
And I think he does touch on that. One of the shootings, he ties it into economics because he says sort of like the corporate media, they say if you work hard for the corporations and you're a good consumer and you buy a lot of useless junk, that's somehow going to get you a girlfriend. So that kind of propaganda, I think, provokes some of those shootings.
Oh yeah, I mean, a lot of these guys like Joseph Westbecker, you know, followed the rules. They did what they were told by society. They went to college or whatever. They got a job. They had a family. They did everything they were supposed to, and in the end, they end up with nothing, less than nothing. And that rage, and in the case of people who are, again, sort of, you know, already on the fringe, that drives them over the edge.
And the other thing is the Manosphere bloggers, they claim that sexual frustration is greater than it was in the past. Would you say that's accurate?
I'd say it is somewhat accurate in terms. I mean, not somewhat. It is very accurate. Slip of the tongue there in terms of because prior to the sexual revolution, prior to free love and whatnot, when monogamy was the norm, most people did in fact get married and most people did in fact have children. But because of the welfare state, to a certain extent, making single motherhood sort of the norm, because women are now encouraged and indeed required to go to college and get jobs, the hypergamous, I guess, status-seeking nature of modern women compels them to, you know, find the average man less and less attractive, which results in a situation where a small minority of men are getting more sex than most everyone else. They're sleeping with more, you know, women than everyone else. And this is borne out by statistics. For example, constant analysis of STD rates among men and women show that women have considerably higher rates of sexually transmitted diseases and venereal diseases than men do. And it's because more women are having sex with a fewer number of men. and a fewer number of men are passing these diseases on to more and more women. I mean, part of it also has to do with the fact that, you know, being the receptive partner, women are more likely to receive diseases, you know.
Yeah, I mean, just as with the homosexuals, the person receiving anal sex is more likely to get AIDS.
But that alone doesn't explain the much, much higher rates. It's because a lot of these women are having sex with only a handful of men because those are the only handful of men that they can be attracted to. You know, with a college degree and a high-paying job, you know, they have to seek higher for that, you know, hormonal, sexual high, as it were. They have to. They're no longer satisfied with, you know, Joe Schmo who goes to work 9 to 5. They have to seek someone who is higher. Higher in society than they are, who is, you know, making more money or whatnot.
And also, women going to the workforce, that also, because it basically doubled the size of the workforce, that also depressed the wages.
Yeah, this is something that Ames did not touch on. He probably should have. But when women entered the workforce en masse at the beginning of the 60s and 70s, that was a boon to corporations because now because with more workers, they can pay employees less. And the really hilarious thing is just how feminists have bought into this as a form of empowerment. You know, it's like you have mainstream sites like Jezebel and Feministing, you know, for successful high flying career women who don't realize that, you know, their very presence in the labor market is ensuring that everyone is worse off, including them. Instead of, you know, coming home instead of working in the home as a homemaker, raising children for a man who loves her, they've become, I guess, sort of wedded to the corporate boyfriend, but they're working longer hours for someone who doesn't love them and, in fact, will terminate them if they're no longer useful or for no reason at all. So the feminists are completely oblivious to how this they've been utterly used by corporations into impoverishing themselves and making the richest people richer.
That's why it's the whole left-right dichotomy is so idiotic, because a lot of the issues that your average person associates with the left are basically issues promoted by corporate interests. And it's the same with immigration. That's one of the other – I think basically – I agree basically most of what Mark Ames is saying is 100% spot on. But the other big flaw is that he basically sounds like your typical leftist – when it comes to talking about how immigrants are being exploited. Not exploited. Of course they're being exploited. I mean, immigrants are being scapegoated. And he points out Pete Wilson's Prop 187, and he totally downplays the role that corporations, like the Silicon Valley, bringing in these H-1B visas to suppress wages.
Yeah, basically. That's the big blind spot in Ames's analysis and the analysis of his comrades. I mean, In a mild defense of him, he just omitted the issue in this book. He's become more militant as of late, you know, talking about immigrant bashers. But that's a simple statistical reality. I mean, if you the labor is a commodity like any other, and if you have more of a commodity, the laws of supply can kick in, and each that commodity is less expensive, workers get paid less. And leftists who promote open borders and amnesty for illegal aliens don't realize how negatively they're impacting the average American worker, because with more workers, employers can pay people less. I mean, last year I was living in North Dakota in the Bakken oil field, trying to get a oil job, and what I found is that In the North Dakota, in the oil fields, there's no job that pays less than $12 an hour, except for being a waiter at like Applebee's, but only because they make tips. And the average wage is more like $16, $17 an hour. And it's because workers are so scarce in the North Dakota oil fields that employers have no choice but to pay those huge extravagant fees. I mean, It's not so much true anymore, but you used to be able to, you know, show up and in Williston or Sydney, Montana, or wherever, and get a job as a roustabout, paying $120,000 a year, $80,000 a year, with no prior qualification. That's how desperate the oil companies were for just warm labor. And the left used to recognize this. Unions like AFL-CIO and the more moderate wing of the Democratic Party used to oppose immigration on this basis because it's bad for the average worker, but that wing is almost entirely dead now. I mean, leftists on one hand claim to want to help the worker, yet at the same time they support a policy that does nothing but hurt the worker.
You know, I've done a couple recent podcasts about this, one with Keith Preston and the other one with Paul Gottfried. And basically, the modern left is that they're cultural Marxists, but they've abandoned the a lot of the economic positions of the old left.
Yes, basically. There's an inherent conflict between – I would put it this way. There's an inherent conflict between economic populism and political correctness, cultural Marxism, and the cultural Marxists have won. The dominant left today is concerned with racism. They're concerned with misogyny. They're concerned with homophobia and transphobia and this phobia and that phobia. But they couldn't give a crap about the workers. You know, when push comes to shove, that's why Occupy Wall Street ended up dissolving under its own internal contradictions. Because on one hand, it was an economic populist movement about criticizing the massive amounts of debt that people have to go through just to get a college degree, just to compete in this economy, and yet they still end up flipping burgers or whatever. But at the same time, they kept trying to make it politically correct, institutionalize it. For example, the so-called progressive stack, which privileged women and minorities over white men in when it came to speak. Because, as it turns out, the vast majority of the people going to Occupy protests, or at least Occupy Wall Street and protests on the East Coast, happened to be white men. So it ended up dissolving under its own internal contradictions. Right now, the current left apparatus isn't concerned with higher wages for, aside from, like, Ames and Yiv Smith and Naked Capitalism and those people. The left is just concerned with, you know, boutique issues like same-sex marriage that have absolutely no bearing on the average American.
Yeah, I mean, and Ames is sort of – at least Mark Ames is on MSNBC. And with the – I mean, the only leftist I know who speaks out about mass immigration is Robert Lindsay. And he's – I mean, he actually jokes that the left won't even touch him with a 10-foot pole.
Oh yeah. Basically, diversity and what's the term I'm going? Diversity and inclusiveness are the organizing principle of the modern left. You can do anything you want so long as you're anti-racist, anti-sexist, in favor of open borders or whatnot. If you cross that border, you're out in the water. You know, and so guys who take a stand on the issue like Robert Lindsay are basically given the line of the long knives treatment by the left. Which is why you get guys like Ames and his partner, Yasha Levine, going balls to the wall on anti-racism, anti-sexism, and open borders, because it's the only way they can get a job. I mean, I'm not bashing it too much. You know, if you're a writer, you have to work in order to eat. But, you know, at the same time, it's disappointing and kind of, you know, contradictory to what these guys do.
What would you say are the biggest flaws in the alternative right and criticizing the left?
I'd say the alternative right. My issue with the alternative right is that they're too focused on. They're not focused enough on economics, as it were. They're better than the mainstream right. You know. God bless them for that. But they don't. To a certain extent, you still have the mentality that free markets are good. That libertarianism to a certain extent is good. I mean, I don't have any and the thing is that, as I mentioned before, we no longer live in a purely capitalist society. We can't, because things are too complicated without this managerial class of administrators and CEOs and whatnot. But we can't simply, you know, talk about cutting government and reducing the size of government in a vacuum, because we had that approach under Reagan, and all it's done is empower CEOs at the expense of the average man. You know, there's not enough coming from the alternative right on this economic reality. There is some, but not enough, for my estimation.
Yeah, they talk more. I'm not saying that the issue of racial issues should be discussed, but they talk about race far more than economics.
Yes, basically, and economics are far more relevant to the average American. I mean, I would say that, say, stuff like feminism and whatnot doesn't really, or even racialism, as it were, doesn't really affect me in my day-to-day life because I live in a largely white area and whatnot. What affects me and what affects the average, American is economics, that sort of thing. It's pocketbook issues, and nobody's talking about them. Nobody's talking. Left isn't talking about them. Right isn't talking about them. And if the alternative right pushed on this a bit more, they'd have a lot more support in terms of pushed on economic populism.
Before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you'd like to say about the spree shootings?
Not at the moment. We've covered just about every angle I could conceivably. Well, oh wait, there's one thing that I forgot to mention. Part of Ames's thesis, and something that I agree with that I didn't really discuss in the review or this interview so far, is the idea that basically, when people are put in an adversarial situation, a situation where they're oppressed or whatnot, that they'll do anything to get out of it. And the reason why slavery was so successful in the US, and the reason why our current regime of downsizing, union busting, and disempowering workers is so successful is because most people are basically have a slave mentality. When they're put in an adversarial situation, they won't fight against it. They'll try to adapt, and that's what we have today. And to a certain and another thing is that another thing that fuels this sort of spree shooting is the idea that suffering of this type makes people into a better person, when in reality it generally makes them into monsters. I mean, I noticed you've interviewed Andy Nowicki. I hope I'm pronouncing.
I've interviewed, several times.
I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. I'm so, if you're listening,
Andy
Andy, I.
Nowicki, yeah, he's written, well, he wrote The Columbine Pilgrim, which was based on Columbine, and he wrote another book about Heart Killer.
Yeah, I
It's
was
called
just.
Heart Killer, where he becomes a pickup artist and then goes back in time and gets revenge on the
Oh.
girls who rejected him.
Yes, I've read and reviewed both. I want to focus on Columbine Pilgrim because that's really that. I would say that is an unofficial fictional companion book to Going Postal. I mean,
But I
his.
will say about Columbine Pilgrim, it's a little different. In Columbine Pilgrim, the character gets revenge specifically on his bullies. He doesn't kill random innocent people.
That's true, but the central idea is that the suffering of the main character is that it doesn't make him a better person. It makes him into a monster, and it's these two twin, misconceptions in American culture that allow spree shootings to happen and allow us to rationalize them away as, just the actions of some crazy mad person. I mean, and we don't see this even though that the few people who did leave slave revolts during the era of slavery were mentally ill, like Nat Turner. He is lionized to a certain extent as a folk hero nowadays, but he was a schizophrenic nutjob who led the slave revolt based on visions that he was getting from, he claimed to have been getting from God. Same thing with John Brown. And to a certain extent, maybe 50 years on, 100 years on, or maybe even a couple decades on, we'll look back at guys like Joseph Westbeker and the Columbine shooters and sort of think, how could society, and think, how could society rationalize this away? I mean, but that's when you build an ideology of lies, all those is make things worse for everyone else. You can only, as Robert Ringer put it, you can only deny reality so long before it starts to hurt you. And right now, denying reality is hurting Americans and Westerners in lar at large. That's what I wanted to point out.
And what I'll add, I mean, I forget his name, but there was a famous prison psychologist who asked people who committed heinous crimes why they did it, and the reason was they were disrespected by that person. But these spree shooters, a lot of times, they feel that not a specific person, but the society as a whole and the whole system is disrespecting them.
Yeah, basically, the goal of spree shooters is to destroy the institution that is oppressing them. Joseph Westbeker's goal was to destroy Standard Gravure, which was the company that he worked at, and he ended up succeeding. Standard Gravure closed its doors a couple of doors years after the spree shooting because he had inflicted so much damage and they received so much bad PR that it just couldn't stay open. And during his shooting, he deliberately excluded shooting certain people because he considered them his friends. And friend in context of a spree shooting means that it was a person who either helped them or did not go out of their way to make their lives hell. Westbeker, and this is the same with the Columbine shooters. There was a kid that they encountered in the shooting that I forget his name, but I think it was I don't remember whether it was Dylan Klebold or Eric Harris encountered this kid that they happen to like, and they said, "You need to get out of here, man. You know, shit's going down. You know, this is your warning." You know, they deliberately refused to shoot this kid, so it wasn't a random shooting so far much as they were targeting the people who were most powerful in that institution and trying to kill them and trying to bring down the institution. The institution is just, you know, people.
So that was Matt Forney. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Oh, thanks for having me, man. You know, it was good talking to you.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.